This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part three of the interview with Dr. Rachel Kraut, who studies language teacher training, language assessment, and online language learning at Rice University in Houston, Texas. There's an overlap of about 10 seconds, so we can pick up right where we left off in the people behind the PhD.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think a lot of people wind up in master's degree programs that way. And I got really lucky. I didn't know how I was going to pay for it. I didn't know what I was going to do for a job while I was getting it. But I fell like ass backwards into funding. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if I can curse.
You can.
So I fell ass backwards into funding that paid for my master's degree. And I wound up with a teaching assistantship in the intensive English language program at the University of North Texas, so I was covered, and I found that opportunity by accident. So I figured, well, looks like this is going to work out, so I'll go through with it.
Okay, so how long did this take you, your master's degree at University of North Texas?
That's a two-year program, and I took the full 2 years to do it. But it wasn't really until, honestly, halfway through that program that my eyes started to open to the possibility of becoming an academic. I was taking some really interesting courses in this master's program, and about halfway through, I was just like, God, this field is so interesting once you get into it at a deeper level like you do in graduate school. And so I had already kind of decided at that point that instead of finishing my master's with comprehensive exams, that I wanted to do a thesis, conduct my own original research and then write it up. And so I was speaking to my master's thesis advisor around my halfway mark, and I asked her about, what's it like to be a professor, an academic? What's it like to get a PhD and all these things? And she gave me some really good advice. She said, you're planning to do your master's thesis. Go through with that and really assess your personal experience of going through that process, because that's what academics do. They conduct research and then they write about it and they present it to people. And she said, if you enjoy the process of doing your master's thesis, you will probably enjoy getting a PhD and going into academia. So, needless to say, I liked it because here I am.
Wow, that sounds like really sage advice, but super practical too.
Definitely, yeah.
Wow. So you finished your master's, and at this point you're thinking, okay, I do want to do a PhD. So then you started applying to programs. What kind of programs are you applying to?
So I was applying to applied linguistics program, and I'll take a second to make a distinction for people outside my field. So there is theoretical linguistics and applied linguistics. Applied linguistics tends to be things more like what I do, like language education, language program building. Theoretical linguistics is the scientific study of language, in and of itself. And there are tons of subgenres in both kinds of field. But the PhD programs for theoretical linguistics versus applied linguistics are very, very different. And the reason I chose to go applied linguistics was, again, the interest in education, but also I had been advised by a few professors during my master's program that it was much easier to get a job if you went applied linguistics versus theoretical.
So where did you had a couple of offers, it sounds like?
Yes. So when I was looking at programs, at applied linguistics programs, I got into and was actually kind of courted by the University of Kansas, by the University of Texas, the University of Texas at Arlington, and then the University of Arizona.
So obviously I know you chose University of Arizona. Why did you choose that for people who maybe they're at a point where they're thinking about doing a PhD at some point? Like, what are the detailed reason you chose that program over the others?
So I chose Arizona over the others because, when I did some campus recruitment visits at all the schools, they invited me to come, paid for me to come out, yada, yada. And you do that to meet the faculty, because when you go through a PhD program, you work so closely with your dissertation advisor that you have to get along. It has to be someone who will support you and mentor you. Otherwise, it's a really miserable experience, or it could be. And so I was kind of trying to feel out, where do I have the best chance for success of a good relationship with an advisor who will invest in me? And so at Arizona, I was able to see that I would have many different opportunities for that. There were lots of professors whose research interests aligned with mine and seemed interested in me and what kind of work I wanted to do. At Kansas, there was only one person. At both places in Texas, there was only one person. And so I said, well, what if those people leave? You know, I've heard horror stories from several people that while they're working so hard to get their doctorate, their dissertation advisor leaves and moves to a different university, and the choice is either follow them there or start over from scratch.
And you didn't like either of those choices, so.
Oh, God, no. No, I wanted a safety net. So I said, well, Arizona, I would have lots of options for a good advisor. And plus, I love warm weather, so that's
where I went. So when you were at University of Arizona, what kind of classes were you taking? What was your journey intellectually at that point?
I started out being really interested in the kind of marriage between psycholinguistics and language education. And that was because I took one psycholinguistics class during my master's degree and it blew my mind. I was like, this is the most interesting thing I have ever studied in my life. And so for people outside the field, psycholinguistics essentially uses different techniques to explore the mental processes or the abstract processes that happen when you either speak a language or acquire your first or your second language. And I was interested in the processes that happen when you acquire a second or a third language. So I took a lot of psycholinguistics classes. I've also always been interested in the skill of teaching reading and learning to read in a second language. So I took a lot of classes about the processes involved in reading and teaching reading as well.
And it sounds like it goes back to your days going to Mexico to teach a little bit.
Yes, and also back to my elementary education classes, believe it or not, because I had, in that major, you have to take a lot of classes about teaching children how to read, because it's a very complex process and not everyone does it well. And it had always interested me, no matter the age group.
Okay, so then tell us, so you're taking a lot of psycholinguistic classes, you're still very much interested in the educational component, especially of second language acquisition and learning and teaching. What was your dissertation? And then during your answer, can you talk some about your statistical models and the things you did? Because I think that part really stands out for me in your background is you've always ventured towards language and so forth. And at one point you said sort of in high school, the science calculus things weren't as interesting, but it seems like you have a really good brain for statistics as well. So maybe you can kind of share that in your methodology in your dissertation research.
Sure. That's funny you say that. It is true. I don't enjoy math in general, but I'm actually pretty good at it. I just don't like doing it, but statistics is an entirely different kind of math. And I've met tons of people who say the same thing, that, no, I don't like math, I'm not good at math, but I really enjoyed the statistics class that I had to take during undergrad. And then for my program, I had to take doctoral level statistics courses, and while most of my classmates, some of them were even crying, they just really hated it and it was difficult, I ate it up. I thought it was wonderful fun, because statistics is, it involves thinking about your data a certain way. And with most math problems, there's one set way to get the correct answer. And that drives me nuts. With statistics, you look at your data, you look at what you're trying to learn from it, and you say, okay, out of all these techniques I know how to run, which one fits my data set the best? And it involves an element of critical thinking that is intriguing to me compared to just like algebra.
And it's a certain amount of creativity, it sounds like, as well, because you have to be very, you have to marry, what you're trying to do with your ability to do that at that moment, and then find some place in between to analyze your data. Sounds like there's some creativity for you involved in statistics.
Yeah, definitely. And I always enjoy, like I've mentioned earlier, I enjoy that kind of thinking and those kind of processes.
This People Behind the PhDs episode is sponsored by Harp Concepts. Are you an up-and-coming artist with a bright idea? Are you a startup company who needs to prove your concept? Or Are you a person who likes to personalize special gifts? Hark Concepts makes high-quality 3D models for a fraction of the price of big-name companies. Learn more at harpconcepts.com. That's harpconcepts.com.
So most of my work is quantitative, partially because I enjoy statistics, but partially I had a professor tell me this one time, and it made sense, that, you know, some academics do qualitative work, which means a lot of interviews and observations, and then people on the other side of the fence like me do quantitative work with numbers and statistics. And it kind of comes down to a difference in how you see the world. Generally speaking, people who do quantitative research feel that the truth is already kind of out there, and it's your job to use various techniques to uncover what exists. Whereas people who do qualitative work tend to believe that we kind of construct our own realities, and that, you know, we make our own experiences, and we learn from observation and things like that.
Wow, that's a really nice distinction. So the quantitative is the truth is already out there. The qualitative is that we construct our own realities. That's the summary of what you just said.
Yeah.
So what was your dissertation topic?
Oh boy, so very in general, overarching umbrella would be reading again. And you see that theme kind of through my publication record now, is that I have very varied interests. But the general theme was processes of reading for adult learners of English as a second language. And so one of my articles was more about the psycholinguistic processes involved in how do adult second language learners of English process complex words, morphologically complex words? And that means words that basically have lots of suffixes or prefixes or both, because they tend to be longer and, like I just said, more complex. So what kind of mental mechanisms do second language learners have to help them get through those more complex words? And how does that affect their reading time compared to native speakers, basically? And then what I found with that particular study was that over time, as you become more proficient in a language, you develop native speaker-like processing mechanisms for complex words. And so that could partially explain why learners who have a lower proficiency in a language really stumble when they get to longer words, because they are mentally not capable of processing them the same way as a native speaker.
So the reading time already sounds like it has a lot of implications for education. I mean, if someone is a second language reader next to a first language reader in the same classroom, and they're taking longer to read, let alone even process the world, it seems like there's a lot of implications already for educational environments.
I'd like to think so, and that was something I've looked at in other studies, and actually that may have been the second article of my dissertation. I don't totally remember, to be truthful with you. That was a while ago.
Yeah, so just to everyone who's listening, if they've listened to other interviews I've done with other PhDs, it's not unusual for a PhD to have certain amnesia about their dissertation. Like, it's something that's so intense in your brain that you know every detail of that dissertation. And then almost the day you're finished defending your dissertation, a lot of these details sort of fade very quickly. And so what Dr. Kraut is sort of getting at is, like, it's okay to forget all of these details. You remember the fundamentals, but some of the details just fade away. Because I've heard this now, Rachel, a few times where people talk about their dissertations, and then some of the details are just, they escape them because it's just something so intense. And once that time is over, they're ready to forget some of the pain that goes into doing all that work.
Oh, absolutely. It's just, and I mean, I have a million other things I have to have in my brain now for work. So, you know, you don't have room anymore for the tiny little things you did as a graduate student, because the work you're doing now as a more experienced professional, let's be honest, it's probably better. So you save your mental capacity for the things that you do now.
So let's, go ahead. I interrupted you there.
Oh, no, it's okay. And I was just going to say, the last article of my dissertation, it was a three-article dissertation, was more about reading and pedagogical practices. So within the setting of an intensive English program, there are certain program models that exist. And so for people who don't know what those are, an intensive English program is usually a program housed at a university where international students who are interested in coming to eventually study for a bachelor's or a graduate degree, maybe their English isn't so great, especially their academic English, so they come to an intensive English program first to improve their English skills. And so I was interested in, you know, well, the structure of these kind of programs are pretty typical around the country. They tend to run in 8-week sessions, whereas, you know, a foreign language class at the university is usually 16 weeks. And so I wondered, I was like, does that 8-week model, is that really enough time for them to learn and truly acquire a language skill like reading that's so complex? And so that third article, I took a bunch of different tests and measurements to basically determine, are they having, you know, significant vocabulary growth, increase in reading comprehension skills, reading speed, interest in reading, just during an 8-week period, is that enough to accomplish anything? And to my surprise, yes, it is.
What were your findings?
Just basically that during the typical 8-week structure of an intensive English program, students actually do have time, at least at an intermediate level, to make significant gains in all of those areas I mentioned: vocabulary, reading comprehension, reading speed, and interest in reading, you know, like to see the importance of reading and things like that. Because I had always assumed, no, you know, that 16 weeks is much more substantial. You can get significant things done, but apparently 8 weeks isn't a bad model choice either. I had always assumed it was market driven.
Okay, so that was a surprise to you.
Yes.
Okay. What statistics did you apply to your data to help you find that result?
Oh boy, like you were saying earlier, the details kind of escaped me. That particular paper had a lot of different statistical analyses involved in it. Some of the simpler ones were things like paired t-test. In I think the first and second articles, I used mixed effects modeling to analyze those data sets. But in general, since we're on the subject of statistical analyses, my favorite one to use, and that you'll see in a lot of my subsequent publications, are linear regression models. I just think those are really fun. And for people who don't know what those are, that is a statistical analysis that lets you see if one factor can predict another one, or if one factor can predict several other ones. There are different kind of regression models that you can run.
So, you know, if a student has a certain attitude about language learning, if that predicts later success and their desire to stay at that university, those kind of things?
Correct. If you were able to find a way to quantify that, either with, like, you know, a survey that had Likert scales, you know, the 1 through 5, and they had to pick, then yes, you could determine if you know, attitude towards language learning determines subsequent success in some other area. Yeah, you could definitely do that with a linear regression model.
Okay. So let's know, now we're kind of coming full circle. So I introduced you, you know, to start the show, that you study language program administration, language teacher training, program evaluation, and language assessment, also online language learning. So 5 different things. So you were able to take a lot of things you've been talking about at University of Arizona to Rice University, which is where you're working now. What kind of things do you do at Rice University?
So right now at Rice, I'm an associate director in the language programs department. And I should qualify that by saying I'm in the continuing studies college at Rice, because there is a credit side to the language programs. But my department is responsible for all of the non-credit language courses that the university offers. So, for example, we have a really popular non-credit foreign language program. We teach 8 different languages. People from all around Houston, usually young professionals, come to improve their foreign language skills. We also have an evening English as a second language program for local Houstonians. We have an intensive English program, which I just defined a minute ago. And then we also have a new online English program, and I am currently writing more online ESL programs.
Oh, so yeah, I mean, Houston, for people who don't know, it's considered, and I think probably stats back this up, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, Rachel, is the most diverse city in the United States of America.
Yes, that is correct.
Yeah, so then having all of these languages you teach to young professionals around Houston is certainly matches the market need in Houston.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you're right next door to the Houston Medical Center. So I imagine there's a lot of people from other places there as well. So it sounds like a really smart idea for Rice to offer those courses, especially given, you know, its location and what an incredible city Houston is.
Yeah. The Texas Medical Center has always been at least, you know, I should say at least, it always has been a fairly steady stream of students coming in for any of the programs because a lot of, I mean, for those who don't know what the Texas Medical Center is, it is the largest medical center in the world. And so people who have very rare conditions come all the way to little Houston, Texas to get treated. And so there are always lots of international visitors in Houston. You know, maybe they have family members who are getting treated at the medical center. And hey, while I'm here, I want to improve my English or my French or my Arabic or whatever. So they come take classes with us.
They can literally walk across the street to Rice University to take those classes.
Yes.
Okay. So just two more questions before we finish up. First is, if someone's listening to this who's thinking about doing a PhD at some point, either like you, more traditional, just straight through, although there's plenty of sort of times in between you weren't certain, or someone who's going back to school later, what would you recommend for someone who is thinking about doing a PhD at some point in their lives?
Well, I mentioned that piece of advice that my master's thesis advisor gave me earlier, and I think it's very smart. If you're thinking about doing a PhD, go get a master's degree first. It only takes 4 semesters. It goes by so fast. Do the thesis option and see if you even like doing research and if you like writing. Because a lot of academics will run into the problem whether they like doing research, but they absolutely hate writing about it. And I got news for you. If you don't enjoy writing up your research, you're not going to do well in a PhD program and you're not going to do well as an academic. So take that, you know, that lower stakes test for yourself first. But beyond that, I would encourage you to do it. If you find that, you know, you are interested in research and these kind of things, going through my PhD was absolutely probably the most challenging thing I've ever done, but I loved all of it. Just the intellectual satisfaction you get from going through a PhD program and meeting, you know, fellow students, whether they're in your field or in a different program.
Such as Dr. Z.
Yeah, just like you. It was just a wonderful experience. I would absolutely do it again. If I had to redo my life, I would not change that.
Thanks for listening to part 3 of the interview with Dr. Rachel Kraut, who studies online language learning at Rice University in Houston, Texas. To continue listening, visit drz.net, that's drz.net/download. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding.